There are two kinds of people in the modern digital world, the influencing and the influenced. Who are these people? And are they having a bit of a lend? Is influence just another way of saying, well, cash for comment? Just another of the diverse expressions of having us on. Is it advertising or is it content? And either way, when that person with the impeccable taste on Instagram expresses unbridled enthusiasm, are we being had? Being an influencer, it sounds like it should be, well, almost self-parody, but in fact, it's a very serious and very lucrative position to occupy. So, how does this new digital aristocracy operate? And more importantly, for our particular area of interest here on Blueprint, how does it work when it comes to the world of food media? Why is it, you might wonder, that you suddenly keep seeing that same new olive oil brand appearing in every greyish apartment of every TikTok food clip, being drizzled over every ceramic bowl of brothy beans? How are these food mediaists doing it, and at what cost or payment? Joining us to make sense of this phenomenon is food writer Alicia Kennedy. Hello, Alicia.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Are you an influencer?
I am not. I am not. I maybe.
How humble.
I am just a writer.
But you have some personal experience of this. As a food writer, there must have been moments when people have reached out, as they say, to offer you the opportunity to talk lovingly of their brand.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's actually welcome. Sometimes it's something I already enjoy and they're reaching out to send me more of it. Maybe it's a ceramics company that I really like, or, you know, it's a lotion that I've recommended to folks for dry skin when they travel or something like that. And so that's always lovely because it comes from that sort of organic space. But in terms of getting compensated for basically producing a commercial for anything, no, that is not in my wheelhouse.
Well, and how is that? I mean, how do you personally negotiate that? I mean, once upon a time in traditional pyramidical gatekeeperish journalism, there were pretty robust rules about this stuff.
Right.
But now that we have the great democratization of media and we have people making content all over the place, I mean, those rules are less conspicuous and not necessarily things that people follow.
Right. And that's kind of the tricky problem with it, is that sometimes it can be very obscure. There are rules in the United States around how explicit it has to be when content is paid for by a brand. But a lot of the times that can be kind of hidden in hashtags or something like that. And it's not always very clear. There's also going to be, of course, that those occasions when, as you noted before in the intro, that an olive oil brand is simply going to appear constantly in the background of every cool video. And so while that might not be paid for content, that is something where a brand has flooded the influencer landscape with their olive oil. And so it kind of becomes, if you're not using that olive oil, then are you really cool? Are you really with it in the space? And so when it can be both pay for play, but it can also be the ways in which influencer marketing is utilized by brands who aren't paying, but are simply flooding that space and getting the cosign of, you know, the people who determine taste.
How does it work in food media in particular? Are there differences in the ways that commercial influence and influence works here compared to other sort of influencer realms, you know, fashion, beauty and so forth? Is food different?
Food is a bit different because at the end of the day, something does have to taste good, right? And we see this happen a lot. We see it happen a lot actually in beauty media where influencers will endorse something and then the masses will come out and say, I bought this and it actually stunk and I didn't like it, even though, you know, this influencer told me that it was great. And at the end of the day, can you really return the makeup if you've already used it and opened it? You're kind of stuck with it. And so even if the beauty influencer is kind of pulling people's legs, eventually they'll be kind of called out for it, right? And so, but at the same time, they're still making money. The brands are still making money. In food, it can be a bit more complicated because, one, a lot of food brands, especially artisanal ones, don't necessarily have the big capital to do the big influencer marketing things, you know? And so they rely on that slower burn. I think there are, you know, spice companies like Burlap and Barrel or Diaspora Co. that have really nice business models, but don't have the money to make themselves ubiquitous in the kitchens of food people unless they actually like the product. And so that's something that food has going for it, which is that people aren't going to rely on a spice unless they really can vouch for it. And, you know, you're going to see bigger magazines like Bon Appetit and, or, you know, the New York Times cooking section or Wirecutter really pitting these items against each other and telling people what's what. And so it is an interesting space because it has a lot of influence. It wields a lot of influence, but I also think there's just not as much money in it as there is when it comes to fashion and beauty. And that sort of keeps people honest on some level.
I suspect too that, I mean, to become an influencer in food online, on TikTok, on Instagram, so forth, there's a pretty high barrier to entry. You've got to be reasonably good at this. You've got to make stuff that works, that is tasty, that is attractive. Whereas doing something in beauty, well, you just got to have a look really, don't you? I mean, there's not as much, I was going to say skill, that's probably not the right word, but that idea of barrier to entry, I think, really applies in food media.
Yeah, there's techniques. And I mean, so in beauty as well, there's definitely a ton of technique there. But when we're talking about food, they're really, people want to trust you. And they come to trust you by seeing you repeatedly executing things properly and repeatedly meeting them where they are in their kitchen. Because, you know, people who love makeup, love makeup. They're going to go buy something at the drugstore. They're going to play with it. But food, in a lot of ways, people have gotten very detached from. And so if you're convincing people to spend time and money going grocery shopping, if you're convincing them to spend time in their kitchen, it's a very unique kind of parasocial relationship in that way, because you're getting someone to spend their time in a way that, you know, they could just order something in, but they're trusting you enough that they're going to spend that time and money in their kitchen, and then they're going to eat the thing and they're going to have to like it or not, and then there'll be hell to pay. But it's really cool to see, actually, I think, in terms of a lot of these food influencers, whether they're getting brand deals or not, you know, they're really getting people back in the kitchen in a way that is very exciting, I think.
How many declare and how many don't declare those background interests?
Well, I think they have, you know, the ones who are really trusted by their audiences are the ones who are very, very upfront.
Yep.
People such like Justine Doron of Justine Snacks, people like Leah Victoria, people who are extremely upfront about when they're doing a brand deal are going to be the ones who have that trust of the audience. Their audience is going to say, I love that you're getting money. I love that you're doing this ad. Those are the comments are just going to, you know, they're not even going to be about the recipe. They're going to be like, get your money, because they're giving enough to their audience trusts them no matter what. And they just want them to make money and keep doing their content.
I mean, and this is the thing about the online world, isn't it? That the reaction is instantaneous and visible to all. And we talk about these sort of patterns of commercial influence, and we should not pretend that back in that old media that this wasn't very much the thing that was happening. And it was probably harder, in fact, to detect in the pre-digital age.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've heard stories of fashion designers withholding ad space because they weren't seeing their clothing presented enough in the editorials. And so this is something that's, you know, it's as old as magazines, this kind of quid pro quo between the editorial and the advertising. And of course, a magazine can't exist if it doesn't have that balance. But in the end, you know, a lot of the time in a magazine, the advertising is very obvious. When sometimes you could be watching a video for a minute and before you realize that it was an ad. And a lot of the time people will comment and say, I didn't know I was watching an ad until the end. And so it can be kind of tricky in that way. But also it's of course going to happen because we do have fewer magazines people reading magazines. We have fewer people watching TV even. And so social media has become the space for our commercialization. And even though there are rules and regulations around what an influencer should be doing in the ad space or how obvious they should be making it that it is an ad or a partnership, you know, it's not always going to be that obvious. I just saw someone doing a brand deal where they're kind of making like an entire, you know, multi-part drama series or comedy series for an ad. And so, you know, things are getting more creative in that way. But at the same time, people are getting fed up when they think they're seeing just ads over and over from everybody. And so it's going to be interesting to see as people are continuing to become content creators and influencers, as it becomes kind of seen as an actual job to aspire to, you know, and the only way to really make money in it is the brand deals. Is it going to get kind of more conspicuous, or is it going to get less, you know, is it going to get less obvious? And so these are the questions that are kind of going to be reckoned with. And there's also the fact that when we're talking about print media and journalism, of course, there were people going against ethics in journalism, but there were these rules at least that needed to be abided by. And now these problems are kind of individualized. They're not being dealt with by an editorial team. And so it's just in a very interesting time for what it can look like in the future for people to actually make money in media.
That idea of things being individualized is key, I think, because the individual content creator, especially if they're starting out, they're trying to make this into a way to earn a living, they're in a really vulnerable and precarious position. And that's an
exactly.
easy position
and,
to take
yeah.
advantage of.
No, absolutely. It's a very easy position to take advantage of. It's going, you know, we see people kind of pretend to fake it. They fake it until they make it, right? And so they're going to be kind of, they're going to be shilling for free, basically. And, you know, a lot of the time rates for a brand deal aren't, you know, there's not a lot of public conversation about this. There's not a lot of the norms haven't been set yet necessarily. There's not a lot of transparency in what people are paid for these kinds of things. And so if you get someone at the right time, you can take advantage of them in this space and get them to shill for a very low price. And that's really the concern, because I think that what worries me when it comes to food media is that if people think that people coming up see this as the way to go forward, they're never going to be critical, really, because they're always going to want to have the ability to make money from a brand. And even if they hate something, even if they hate the cool olive oil, they're not going to say it. And that makes it less of, you know, journalism as public service is kind of really, really falling by the wayside as media sort of shrinks and collapses. And we have more and more influencers and content creators who aren't actually doing journalism or don't feel a kind of debt to the public.
Yeah. The counter trend to all of this de-influencing, explain that idea to us, Alicia.
So in fashion and in beauty, there has been a call to de-influence, which is to tell folks about the things they hate, the things they regret buying.
I have a list.
You know, well, it all has to do with concerns around consumption. You know, we're seeing people who are doing big hauls of fast fashion from Shein or from Zara. And people are concerned that it's giving people the wrong idea about how much they can consume, especially within planetary limits. If they have any concern for labor rights and garment workers and that sort of thing. And so there is this new trend. We haven't seen it hit food yet. There hasn't been a big de-influencing moment around food. And I guess it also speaks to the ways in which food is, you know, it is trend driven, but it's also very personal. And so,
yes. You
know, it can be a little more squishy to take over in that way. But, you know, I think that it would be important to have a little bit more criticism and honesty in food around, you know, the things that everyone's buying, the restaurants that everyone's going to and that sort of thing. And so I would like to see de-influencing hit the food world.
De-influencing. We needn't be afraid of it. Alicia, thank you. Great thoughts. And if this conversation has sparked your interest, Alicia is on her newsletter, has written on this, a piece there called Securing the Brand Bag. We'll pop a link to Alicia's newsletter on the Blueprint page. Alicia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alicia Kennedy, food writer.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.